Hello, this is Down the Back of the Seats. I'm Ellen, Cinema Manager at Campbelltown Picture House.
And I'm Alistair, Film and Theatre Maker from the Isle of Mull.
Alistair, what is this podcast about?
This podcast explores what happens when public spaces and the public meet. What's left behind? What's been found that's unexpected? What stories are there to tell? It's tales from behind the scenes at the cinema, theatre, concert hall, wherever people meet, linger, and leave things. Or bits.
And we must start with an apology for our extended hiatus, which was never the plan. What happened there, Alistair? Oh, wait, it was me.
Was it? I think it could equally have been me. I think I caught COVID and I was knackered for months.
Sorry. And I was going to move house, but then I didn't move house and we're not talking about it. Cinema. What have you seen? Where have you been?
So I have, over the last few months, I've been a few different places, not too many, but I've been to Dunoon, and I went to see Beetlejuice a few months ago, and that was really good. It was really interesting to see such kind of strong female lead characters, and I thought that was excellent. It was magic seeing Winona Ryder again. I'm very fond of her work. I think she's really got a lot of charm. Mm. She's just a really good actor. And I thought Jenna Ortega as the daughter was fantastic. She really, really did a brilliant job. And yeah, it was really interesting. And of course, Catherine O'Hara, who played the stepmother to Winona Ryder's character in the original film, it was interesting to see their relationship grow and develop as well without the presence of a convicted sex offender playing the father, which was just horrible to know that he's, you know, that legacy's there. But they did that very well. They just basically bit his head off and just had people wandering around with just arms and flapping about, pretending to be the character. Actually, that's one way to do it. There is a film that we're both very excited about, which follows on from The Quiet Girl and Cullen Keown from Ireland. I think that was one of the best films I've ever seen. I really do. And I was just working with a young woman who's 21 years my junior on a project in Golspie in the northeast of Scotland, a town you know very well, Ellen. And I was over the moon to be there. I went to Golspie when I was a young man. I was 16 or 17. And I took part in the mod there and got put off Gaelic for 20 years by my experience there, which was a sort of cumulative effect of things. And it was just, when I was at the mod there, I was like, you know what, this is not for me. So it was really nice, some many years after coming back to Gaelic, to go back to Golspie and to be doing workshops with the young people there. We had, in the mornings, 8 young people who were, we were making a film with, and we, you know, got the chance to say, you know, what do you want to make a film about? Something serious, something poetic, something profound. And they went, we want to make a monster movie. It's like, okay, we're making a monster movie. And the project's called Every Child a Filmmaker, from Into Film. And it is about enabling young people to make films and have, you know, realise their hopes of making a film. And so 2 professional filmmakers are involved in shepherding that through. I was one of them, and my friend Hannah Hunter was the other. And Hannah is just brilliant. I'm so pleased to have worked with her. The future of filmmaking is in safe hands. The level of inquiry that she had and level of knowledge that she had, I just think fantastic. So I'm hopeful that Hannah will become a colleague for many years to come. But we were talking about favourite films, Hannah and I, and The Quiet Girl came up for both of us there. It was Hannah that suggested it first, and I went, yeah, gosh, that really was. And for me, it has one of the greatest shots in cinema ever. I think I might have mentioned this in the podcast, but it's been so many months since we've done it that I must apologise if I mentioned it before. There's a point where in The Quiet Girl where the young girl is from a family of 36 and she's child number 35 or something like that. So there's many, many in the family anyway, and her mum says, look, I'm having the next one's coming, you just need not to be here, I need to just have a bit of space. And so she's sent to live with a distant auntie and uncle who she doesn't know in more rural Ireland. And the wee girl's really quite, she's fierce, she's got her own way, but she's also quite timid. And there's a shot when she comes to the new house to meet her auntie and uncle, the first shot that where she encounters her auntie, which really, really just blew my mind. And it's, the door opens and we see, from the little girl's perspective, the auntie kneeling down to say, hello, do you want to come out? And then we see a reverse of that, where we just see the wee girl looking back at her. And it's so simple and so sincere, and in Irish Gaelic as well, or Gaelic. It's just, oh, it's just beautiful. It really is. And that's the tone of the film. It just keeps going in this register of beauty. But I didn't know there was a film coming based on another novel, short novel, by the same author as that. Ellen, do you want to say more about this? Well, instead of me rabbiting on wholeheartedly.
No, it's fine. Small Things Like These is coming out, which is, it's a different filmmaker and it's in English, but it is based on a book by the same name, or by Claire Keegan again, who wrote Foster, which is the book that The Quiet Girls is based on. And it is, you've read the book.
I love it. Yeah, I got it here. And my dad came over to visit a few weeks ago, and the weather wasn't great. And I said, just passed him over that. And he just sat on the couch and read it in an afternoon and just thought it was brilliant.
Yes, very short. Both Foster and Small Things Like These, very short books, which is good for film because you can have everything in them. And yeah, it's a very slow book, and but it looks like it's going to be a very slow film. The film is out, actually, but we're starting to screen it from tomorrow, so I haven't seen it yet. I was going to watch it this morning, but a different film overtook, which I'll talk about in a minute. So, yeah, really looking forward to it. And then we were chatting about it on the phone the other day, weren't we? And then we started thinking about cinema in a different language, but specifically niche languages.
Yeah.
Irish Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic, and
yeah, there's so few films, there's so few feature films in Scottish Gaelic.
Are there any feature films really in Scottish Gaelic?
There's one, it's called Shach, The Inaccessible Pinnacle. It's produced by Chris Young, who produced The Inbetweeners.
All right. Is it good? Is it?
I've got it, but I haven't seen it.
You've not watched it. There's one.
No, I don't know. It doesn't really appeal.
There's one film that exists in your second.
The language of my heart.
Exactly. Your favourite language. It's one film. right. Before we speak again, I want you to have watched that. Have you got it on Blu-ray?
I do have it on DVD. Yeah. Right. It just looks a bit sort of, I don't know. I'll watch it and I'll get back to you.
Okay.
I just want something that's fun. I'm so fed up of...
It might be like The Inbetweeners.
I think not. Eitr na chlachan. No. Eitr da chlach. No, I don't think so. That's a slightly rude joke for those that speak Gaelic there.
I just laughed along like I knew what you were saying.
Yes, and this is so the way that nations represent themselves on film is really, really interesting. And it's not a question of language, it's a question of how they express themselves through different cultural memes and, well, the genetic sense of a meme. Like Richard Dawkins identifies these kind of cultural genes that we have. And so the meme has become these wonderful kind of snippets that encapsulate so much by so little. But national film cultures express themselves through choices of shot and structure and story and sequencing and location and approach. It's a very big and complex picture. And this is called dialect cinema. And the cinema that's about reflects a kind of nature of where it's from. So each nation has its own dialect and cinema. And I've probably said this before, in fact, I know I have. French cinema being one of the great examples that, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, it starts off with these wide farces with everyone's bums, bollocks, and boobs out. And whoops, well, it's all whoops, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it's just crass French vulgarity in the most wonderful of ways. And people love them. People absolutely love them. But those filmmakers, those actors then proceed on to make much more serious things and much more kind of broader things, and then much more kind of films that connect with everyday concerns, or films that are kind of abstract. And a national dialect of cinema was kind of really, really developed. And I mean, French dialect cinema, you can argue, goes back all the way to kind of Jean Vigo and Jean Cocteau and things like that as well. Like Jean Vigo being one, oh God, I love Jean Vigo. Have you ever seen any of Vigo's work at all? Oh God, sorry, proper cinematic. Oh, but so Vigo was a poor soul who, his dad was an anarchist called Almereda. It's sort of Spanish for an anagram for it's all shite. Almierda. And he was brought up by this anarchist and, you know, brought up in an anarchist cabal and did all sorts of fun things. There's a film called Lust for Life by Julian Temple about his life, which is it's actually really good. I like Julian Temple. He's really interesting. Anyway, Jean Vigo had lung problems and wasn't a well man at all. And his most famous film is something called Zéro de Conduite, Zero for Behaviour, which then inspired Lindsay Anderson's classic If. And it features a gentleman of restricted height, as we'd say now, as the headmaster of the school, and the children revolting against this private school, against it. Amazing. Anyway, it's got loads of great stuff that kind of runs throughout the rest of French cinema, but there's one, even I would say, that has even more stronger impact on French cinema, called L'Atalante, and it's about a canal barge called the Atlanta, basically, L'Atalante. And oh, I just love it. It's so imaginative. There's a brilliant moment where a young man is dreaming of this woman that he wants to marry, and he's lying in his bunk in the L'Atalante, and it goes to kind of not even split screen, it just sort of softens the opacity on another frame above it, and she's there swimming in a wedding dress in the water floating, and it's just like, oh my goodness, it's so beautiful, so imaginative, and just everything you kind of want cinema to be, like hyper real, trans real, you know, gone. It's just, oh, it's your imagination brought to life. I bloody love it. Anyway, that's a lot of French dialect cinema has its roots in that. And then this is a lecture on French cinema. In some parts of the 1970s and 80s, it steps very much away from that and goes for the most literal, dullest things you could ever wish to see. There's a French filmmaker, Eric Rohmer, and I cannot stand Eric Rohmer's films. They're so literal and so ponderous, and just, I cannot stand them.
Don't watch them then.
No, I don't. I've seen enough, but when I was in France working one time at the Cinematheque, I had lunch with his leading actress without realising it, and she was so lovely. She was so, so nice. And then I was looking after her, so I was like, oh, that's her. That was Marie Rivière. I was like, oh, wow. Anyway, so yes, each culture expresses itself through, you know, its cinematic history, that each film comes out, it's, you know, it fits into this dialect of cinema. And I think there is a dialect of British cinema that is there. There's a very strong, particularly Paddington 3, which we'll talk about, the Paddington 2 movie. I think that fits into kind of the apex of British cinema. That really is absolutely fantastic. But Scottish cinema doesn't really have its own dialect. There's not enough of it seen around. There's loads of the documentaries, which are fantastic, but there's not many in the way of feature films. And the few that I have seen really don't make me happy or represent my intentions and interests at all. There's one film about Christmas which gets shown on BBC One, unfortunately, sometimes, and it's possibly the biggest piece of shit I've ever seen in my life. I just cannot stand it. And then you've got something like Local Hero, which is the total opposite of that, which is the most amazing film. I love it. It's so sincere, it's fun, and that represents abstractions and aspects of life here in Scotland that I know and understand. And it's, so the question of Gaelic cinema as well as part of that as well, like, you know, how does Gaelic as a minority language on the edge express itself through cinema? And Film G is very much this is a film competition for Gaelic filmmakers of all ages and non-Gaelic filmmakers of all ages who want to use Gaelic. It's very much part of this, taking it forward. But I'm not sure how many people watch the films of the past of Film G. And that's the thing with the cinema dialect, is that you have to know the films of the past and implicitly express their kind of approaches and thoughts or reactions against those thoughts and approaches in your own work. And I don't think we're at a stage in Scottish and Gaelic filmmaking that we can say, okay, that's what we relate to, the naughty comedies of the 1960s or 70s, and we're reacting against that. I don't know if we have our own national dialect of cinema, and I'd love to know more about that. That's going to need edited down. I'm so sorry, there's so much in there.
No, it's good.
I do apologise.
That's what we're here for. Well, while you were doing that, I was looking up, I was reminding myself.
I was smoking a fag.
No, I was reminding myself of some New Zealand films and some films in Te Reo Māori. Which I don't speak.
No.
And I realised I haven't seen that many films that are exclusively in Te Reo Māori. The Deadlands is superb, but very, very violent. And there's a lot of killings in it. Mm-hmm. There was that. And there's another film that I haven't seen that I'd really like to see, which is Fina, which is about Dame Fina Kupa. She was a Māori and women's rights advocate. And I haven't seen it, but I'd really like to see that. And I believe that is mostly, if not all, in Te Reo Māori. But then most New Zealand films, I think I'm exaggerating, generalising for effect, but contain some Māori, because people just use Māori words in everyday speech anyway.
Boy ends with poie, which is
fantastic. Exactly, yeah, Boy's in a beautiful film called The Dark Horse, which is just a wonderful, wonderful New Zealand film, not to be confused with the other film called The Dark Horse, which is about a racehorse in Wales. Mm. Also a lovely film, but not as good as The Dark Horse, the Kiwi
version. You do like equine cinema, don't you?
I do. Yeah, but there's no horse. It's about chess, actually. Well, it's not about chess, but it's about a guy who plays chess. The Dark Horse, that's my recommendation of the week. And then, of course, Whale Rider, Once for Warriors. Mm. They all sort of come up with a bit of Te Reo Māori. But I don't know enough about it. And I'm obviously not Māori myself, so... I don't really
You've been in Scotland longer than you've been in New Zealand now,
haven't
you?
I've been in Scotland longer than I've been in New Zealand. I've been in England longer than I've... Sorry.
Away with that. I love English culture. I was listening to... I'm really very fond of old English-style singing, so June Taylor and people like that. And I found an album by Maddie Pryor and... June Tabor called The Silly Sisters, and it's a double act they have. Yesterday I was listening to that. I just love those harmonies. They're brilliant. Just not so keen on the politics.
I don't think I've got anything interesting to say about that subject. Goodbye.
Oh, well.
I have written down Rams while you were talking as well.
I'm still keen to see that.
Piece of Icelandic cinema. Not to be confused, although the Australian remake does have Sam Neill in it, so obviously it's brilliant. But the original Icelandic Rams is superb. And it feels very Icelandic, but I don't really know what I mean by that.
Yeah,
it's just because it's sort of men not saying much to each other and grunting and then looking at sheep.
Have you seen the film Lamb from Iceland as well?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh my God. Do you have Mubi at all?
No.
It's on Mubi. Lamb is superb.
Are they all very sheep-based Icelandic cinema?
Yeah, it's a folk horror about sheep.
Ooh, like another New Zealand film, Black Sheep.
Black Sheep. It's not like Black Sheep, unfortunately. But it's a pared down. It deals with archetypal myths from Iceland of half... human half sheep things. There's something that can impregnate. it's so worth seeing because it's a very fine line that it walks along, and I love it. I need to watch it with my family soon. It's really, really good. The way it's done is superb. It's you'd really like it. It's
okay. I will add it to the list. Iceland has got a great cinema.
Oh my God, yeah.
Tradition. Scandinavia's got a great...
Definitely fits in with that. Yeah, I must admit, of all the Nordic nations, a lot of the Swedish cinema I've seen really connects with me because there's a really good sense of fun within a lot of the stuff I've seen. And I'm working in Estonia later on this month at the Puff, the Dark Nights Film Festival there. And I've got to see some amazing Scandinavian cinema there in the past that doesn't quite get kind of releases elsewhere, or you know, as major mainstream releases. And it's really interesting because a lot of that there, again, dialects about knowing the past of your cinema and absorbing it without thought, or regurgitating it without thought, or reacting against it without thought. And a lot of these places, like in Sweden, Norway, and Holland, actually, not those Scandinavian, they've got films for young people that are made by filmmakers for young people. We don't really have that here in the UK. We used to have it with the Children's Film Foundation, and that inspired me a lot. There's no two ways about that. I'd still, you know, and I also look at Mark, what do you call him, that directed Innes Men and Bait.
I can only think of Mark Cousins, and it's not
him. I can only think of Mark King from Level 42.
Right, it's not Mark King, it's not Mark Kermode, it's not Mark Cousins.
It's not behind me here, it's Mark Jenkins.
Jenkins, right.
Sorry, Mark, I do apologise.
No,
not that you listen, but
we're not.
You know, he was very much inspired by the Children's Film Foundation films in making Innes Men, because he, you know, it references Haunters of the Deep very strongly in there, and so much so that Haunters of the Deep goes out on Blu-ray, or you know, with it as a B feature, which is great. An extra, as they call them in these contemporary times. So yes, Scandinavian cinema, like Swedish cinema, there's a film, I don't know why it's not had more of a release, called Sound of Noise. Have I ever given you a copy of this film? Legally, of course.
Sound of Noise, no.
But yeah, Sound of Noise is well worth checking out. It's a really good, fun film. And some Danish comedies, you see, they're just so brutal, it's brilliant. I need to ask you then, we've talked about dialect cinema. Let's pursue that avenue further by talking about emergent film within the British dialect, or English, particularly English, I'd say, dialect of film. Paddington, say.
Paddington.
The third Paddington.
The great Paddington. Yes, I watched Paddington in Peru this morning. Now, I need to start. So it's very fresh. I finished watching it about 40 minutes ago. And Paddington 1 and Paddington 2 are in, unironically and without any sort of reservations, are in my top 10 films of all time.
Without a shadow of a doubt, Paddington 2 is the greatest British film of all time.
I genuinely believe that. And I know you generally. And it's difficult to express to people how like that is true. That is...
No, it's superb.
It is one of the greatest films that's ever been created.
It's so sincere. It's so much fun. The performances, it's just, the whole thing is wonderful.
It's perfection. So, like most people, I don't think I'm sort of unique in this, but I've got a great affection for the Paddington films.
Yeah.
And there has been no, in my opinion, no perfect trilogy ever, except potentially Toy Story, but then Toy Story made a fourth, which isn't a bad film, but
it's
ruined.
Not amazing,
but it's not amazing, and it ruined the perfect trilogy, because up until then, the Toy Story was the only, in my opinion, the only perfect trilogy, and I'm including the Three Colors trilogy in that, because though it is.
Mr. Kozlowski will be so upset.
Well, it's not. It's brilliant, but it's not perfect. Whereas Toy Story, anyway. So Paddington. So I was very hopeful and concerned that the third Paddington would make up the perfect trilogy, or would not make up the perfect trilogy.
Taunt me no more, tell me the truth.
It's fine.
Oh.
But if the two previous Paddingtons hadn't existed, then it would be great. It's a great film. It's a lot of fun. The plot works. Everybody's hilarious. Anthony Banderas is brilliant.
He always is.
Olivia Colman is as superb. But I laughed out loud at Olivia Colman a lot, but it was generally just her being Olivia Colman and doing funny sort of tics and stuff, and I found that hilarious. It's a great film, but it's not good enough. It's not. It doesn't have the same magic. We're missing Sally Hawkins, which is a disaster, obviously. Emily Mortimer, brilliant. She's great.
She's a fine actor, yeah.
But there are parts of it that take you out of the story, because you go into it goes into sort of flashbacks sometimes, which involve Sally Hawkins, but they can't have Sally Hawkins' face in it, obviously, because then you're going, hang on a minute, this flashback doesn't make any sense because it's Emily Mortimer. So in the flashbacks, it's Emily Mortimer, but that doesn't. But then you know that it used to be Sally Hawkins because it's recreating the same scenes from. Yeah. It's very odd, but it is great, and I cried and I laughed and I love Paddington. But the disappointment is quite crushing because I wanted a perfect trilogy.
Why was Sally Hawkins not part of it? Is it
I don't know. Scheduling. Scheduling, I would imagine. If you are going to go and see Paddington, you have to stay until at least halfway through the credits, and you'll see the point that you have to stay in, because there's a bit in the credits and it is brilliant and it is hilarious. It's funnier. It's the funniest bit in the film. That's not to say that the rest of the film is not funny as well, but you have to wait. Even though, as a cinema person, we want you all to fuck off so that we can start cleaning. But, but for this, I will make an exception.
Well, that's fab to hear that it's good. But I hope it connects stronger with other people. That's.
It's because expectations are not even too high. They're just unmanageably high. However brilliant the film was. Although that was the same with Paddington 2, because I actually prefer Paddington 1 to Paddington 2. But when I went to see Paddington 2, my expectations were absolutely in the sky. And Paddington 2 even managed to surpass those expectations.
Work of great skill.
Improve would do the same. But it didn't, but it's brilliant.
Paddington 2 it really is the finest British film. It really just is amazing. Mm-hmm. This also makes me, so when I'm working in Estonia in a few weeks' time, one of the things I'm doing is hosting a panel on why does violence sell in children's cinema instead over kindness
in children's cinema.
Yeah, because you think of like
sort Home
Alone,
Tom and Jerry violence or violence.
Exactly.
Violence. Right.
Yeah. So Home Alone being a classic example of it, and all these, you know, that's we all look forward to those moments that if they're real life, those poor people would be dead. Kevin's a psychopath. You know. Although I will probably watch at least one of those movies again this Christmas. So the contrast to this, very interestingly, is the Wild Robot. How did the Wild Robot go down?
Really well. But most kids loved it, we got, mainly due to the way that I was marketing it and telling people to come and see it, we got a lot of adults coming to see it without children and seniors.
Cool.
My gang of seniors came to see it.
And how did it go down with everyone?
Loved it. And everybody has loved it. There's one person that came out and said they thought it was okay, and I punched them in the face.
And then they died.
And then they died. Because they had no heart. Yes, everybody's loved it because it's wonderful. And kids have loved it as well, but they've got completely different things out of it.
Yeah, my mate Ewan said he watched it with his kids and he would give it, I think he said 7 out of 10, which I thought was a very strong rating. So.
That's not enough, Ewan. Can you send Ewan to me so I can punch you? That sounds like he said it was fine. I'm going to punch him in the face. I'm coming for you, Ewan.
Watch out, Davidson, she's on her way. I'm desperate to see it because I really want to see it before I go to Estonia so I can, you know, have it in as a point of comparison for the other films we're going to talk about. But I don't know if I'm going to find anywhere where it'll be on. It won't be kind of streaming, and so I might just have to be. Has anyone seen Wild Robot? How does this fit into this picture?
Yeah, because Wild Robot is very much kind. It's the kindness thing.
Yeah.
The thing that made my friend Emma cry the most, she said, is that the fox gets some friends at the end. And she was crying because he got some friends, because he never had friends before.
I like the sound of that so much. And I am working on another cinema podcast as well, called 969, A Journey Through Film, which Ellen will hopefully be guesting on at some point, if that's okay. And it's 969 was my old video card number, and it's going to be talking with film and cinema professionals and people who work in the arts and also in journalism as well about what cinema means to them within specific features. So like what films connect with them through music, what films connect with them through kind of the long take, you know, that fantastic unbroken shot. What films connected to them with specific types of situation, like, you know, romantic comedies or bottleneck scenes or bottleneck films, all these kind of things, like Lifeboat by Alfred Hitchcock. You ever seen Lifeboat at all? I went to watch it with the family this weekend. It's absolutely fantastic. A German U-boat. It's based on a short story, well, actually a scenario by John Steinbeck, which I'm in immediately. But there's a liner crossing international waters is sunk by a German U-boat, and there's a handful of survivors on this lifeboat, and they pick up some German sailors. It's just wonderful. It's a perfect kind of bottleneck film. Really, really good. So 1969 Journey Through Film will be coming probably about end of this year, start of next year. But there's preparations are underway.
Lovely. Right, time to stop.
Thank you very much. Lovely to speak to you, listener. See you again.